Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi there, this is Seth Abramovich, senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter. Thanks for coming back for another episode of It Happened in Hollywood. This week, we're going to be doing a film that was almost inspired by E.T., but not quite. I'll explain that and more on this week's It Happened in Hollywood. So this season, we've had some incredible guests, and the next one, I am so excited that he's part of It Happened in Hollywood Season 3. His name is John Sayles, and if you don't know the name, you definitely know his films. He's been making films forever, and some of his most famous ones are The Secrets of Roan Inish, Sunshine State, Passion Fish, and probably most famously, Lone Star, the 1997 film with Matthew McConaughey that earned John a Best Original Screenplay nomination. Now, like so many greats, including Martin Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola, John Sayles got started in the Roger Corman factory and quickly proved to be quite a talented screenwriter. And he wrote Piranha, actually, which was sort of a ripoff of Jaws, but it so impressed Steven Spielberg that he hired him to write a treatment for a sci-fi film that he had in mind. That film would eventually become E.T., but John left that project early on. Then he won a MacArthur Genius Fellowship and took that money and put it into an indie sci-fi script that he had written called The Brother from Another Planet. He put Jewel Morton in the lead role as the alien, who pretty much looks like a human being except he has three toes on either foot. And he lands in Harlem, and it's the ultimate fish out of water story. When I saw the film, you know, as a kid, it really made a big impression on me. I was sort of amazed at, even though it was super low budget and you knew that the effects were, you know, just being made on the fly, it somehow still worked emotionally. And it made me realize, you know, how great a good script and a good director, how far that can really take a project. So I reached out to John, and to my delight, he said he would be into going through the paces of The Brother from Another Planet. So without further ado, here we go. John Sayles, it's a thrill to meet you. You're a legend in the film business, so it's great to have you here.
It's good to be here. It's good to be a legend in somebody's mind.
More than just mine. I'm thrilled that we're doing The Brother from Another Planet, which is a movie that I saw as an early teen and made a huge impression on me. But before we get into it, I'd like to talk a bit about your sort of unique niche and how you found your place in filmmaking. I know you started in sort of the Roger Corman school, like a lot of great directors. And if you could just give a brief rundown of how you broke in.
Yeah, I kind of wrote my way in. I was writing fiction and started to get some of that published in magazines, and got a novel published. And Francis Dole, who was Roger's right-hand person, who was like half the company at New World, and did pretty much everything that Roger did to get movies made. I think she handed on a short story of mine that was an Atlantic Monthly magazine to Roger. He read it and said, like, well, we should hire this guy. And it was right as I came out to LA to try to start working for the movies. And they hired me to do a rewrite of the movie Piranha, which was basically I think, as Steven Spielberg said, it was a Jaws spinoff, but it was the best Jaws spinoff. And
sure.
That's when I met and started to work with Joe Dante, who I did several projects with. And so I wrote three movies for Roger, and then I kind of wrote two movies for graduates of Roger, Louis Teague and Joe Dante, when Louis did Alligator and Joe did The Howling. And with that money, I made Return of the Secaucus 7 with the $40,000. Because this is, you know, these guys were signatories to the Writers Guild, but it was, you know, you only made $10,000 scale back then. And then that got into a couple festivals and eventually got a theatrical release. And so I was kind of on the board as a director as well as a writer. There's been a long history of writers eventually getting to direct. John Huston is one. What's his name? Who wrote Jurassic Park and the books for those eventually got to direct. It's rarer that novelists like me also direct. There's only a handful. I think Elia Kazan, when he stopped being able to get movies made, started writing novels. And there's really, you can name them on one hand, novelists who also direct. But quite a few screenwriters have made that leap. And by using my own money to make Secaucus 7, I kind of moved that up several years, I think.
Yeah, well, very few screenwriters went on to become directors. So amazing that you were able to accomplish that so early on. And, you know, you mentioned Spielberg liking Piranha. And in researching Brother, I did not realize quite how non-coincidental the similarities between it and E.T. are. So if you wouldn't mind telling us the story of Night Skies.
Yeah, I had been hired by Steven's company to write a movie called Night Skies, which was kind of based on an incident that he ran into when he was doing his research for Close Encounters. And it involved the Men in Black show up at some point in it. And I had heard of them because I had read some UFOlogy before. And it was kind of like, I always likened it to Drums Along the Mohawk with ETs attacking a little farmhouse instead of Indians. And Ron Cobb, who was quite a good cartoonist and production designer, art guy, he was slated to direct it. While we were working on it, he was one of the people doing production design for Conan. So the one big meeting that I remembered happened in Paris, and Spielberg had come from a scout for the Indiana Jones movie, and Ron had come from Spain where they were shooting Conan, and I came from Hoboken, and we all met in Paris for one night, and I did another draft, I believe. And then I think what happened was Columbia decided they had Starman, the Jeff Bridges movie. And I think, it was after 1941, which was Spielberg's first movie that didn't make a mint. Mm-hmm. And they just said, another science fiction thing, we're not interested. So he moved on. And when he moved on, I started working on another movie. And pretty much the very last page of Night Skies is the very half of the very first page of E.T. And, I just kind of knew they had gone on with a somewhat different story. And then because for arbitration, the Writers Guild, if you were on the chain of writers in a project, they sent it Melissa Matheson's script to me. And quite honestly, as a writer for hire, usually the scripts that you read aren't very good because you're being asked to rewrite them. And I just read this and I said, well, this is a great script. And it really doesn't have much to do with what I wrote, so I didn't ask for any credit. And I, in my wisdom, thought, oh, this will be a nice little Disney movie. I had no idea it would go platinum. But I thought it was really good, just even on the page. there are a lot of good movies that aren't that impressive on the page, and you know, the whole thing comes together to make a great movie. And that was the one where I really thought, well, this is a really good script, and this is different than other science fiction stuff that I've seen.
But the sort of menacing invasion tone ended up producing, I think, Poltergeist.
You know, I think there's echoes of it in other things. You know, Joe later on made Gremlins, which is kind of the broad humor version of something like that. But, you know, I run into this all the time as a screenwriter. There's a lot of ideas that are somewhat similar floating out there.
Right.
And so I never really feel like I've been pickpocketed very badly. And, you know, everybody always asks me with Return of the Secaucus 7 about The Big Chill. And I always just feel like, well, it's called The Big Chill for a reason. It's about a bunch of people who are realizing that they've lost their ideals or maybe never had them in the first place. And The Return of the Secaucus 7 is about people going in the exact opposite direction. You know, so it is about a bunch of college friends meeting for a weekend, but they go in such different directions. It's like, you know, complaining about a Western because there's a horse in it.
Okay, so it's still fascinating to me to know that your kernel became E.T. And then, so after that, you read the script and it goes on to its thing. Did that plant something in your mind that became The Brother or
no? No, the Brother is actually the only movie I ever made that is based on dreams. I forget which movie it might have been, Liana, that I was doing the sound mix for. And you have, you know, sound mix in those early days. It really invaded your mind because when we did Liana, they didn't even have high speed backup. So you heard the soundtrack forward and then at the same speed. And you do that all day and you're going to have some very strange dreams. And you're under pressure because it was a very low budget movie. And, you know, every day in a mix studio, we had like a 5-day mix or something and we had to get it done. I had a dream where I was writing a movie for Joe Morton that was called Assholes from Outer Space. And it was kind of a comedy thing. And there were these people with little antennas and they came down and they were just really awful. And they got jobs at the motor vehicle department and stuff like that. And I woke up and I thought, you know, well, that's like a Saturday Night Live skit. That's not really a movie. And the next night I had another dream where I was directing and it was a film noir that looked an awful lot like Odd Man Out. But it was called Bigfoot in the City, and it was set in Seattle, and there was a Bigfoot being chased through the city and, you know, a lot of wet down cobblestones and things like that. And then the third night, I had a dream that was about an African-American man walking down 125th Street, and he seemed totally lost. And in the dream, the way you realize things without them being played out, I said, oh, he's lost because he's not from this planet. Mm-hmm. And I kind of woke up and I said, well, there's an idea there. And maybe if I, you know, combine some of the comic elements of the first dream and some of the film noir elements of the second dream with this basic idea, that would be really interesting to have a black man in Harlem who knows less than a white guy from Iowa knows about what's going on there in some right. ways. So he's got to assimilate very quickly. But you get to see the world through his eye and just question things that were never questioned before. That I wrote very quickly. We had been planning to make Mate One for about $1.5 million and the money fell through. Just like the people who were going to give us money were taking a bank loan and the bank said no. And they called us up and said no. And I had a meeting with Maggie Renzi and Peggy Reisky, the producers. And I said, well, look, this is a big disappointment, but I have another movie in mind. And I told them what I knew of the story. Then they said, but it's going to be winter soon. And I said, you start producing and I'll start writing. And I think in about 4 weeks, we were shooting the movie.
Wow.
I remember writing it madly. I was doing rewrites on Clan of the Cave Bear at the time, and they flew me out to the West Coast And I got on the plane at Newark, and they flew me out first class. This is how long ago this is. They flew a writer first class anywhere.
that was rare for the time.
Yeah, it was rare even then. And the stewardess who checked me in said, "Well, you won the prize." And I said, "What's the prize?" And said, "You'll see." So I sat down as the very front row, like the bathroom is behind us. It's so far forward, and Paul Newman is sitting next to me.
Oh, wow.
And so I'm writing away because I've got a nice 6-hour flight to get some of my own work done. And at some point, somebody recognized me who I'd had a meeting with, who thought I knew Paul Newman. And he came up and said, "Hey, how you doing? You're trying to write a screenplay in a, you know, single flight." And I said, "Well, that's the idea." And I don't know Paul Newman. So he walked away pissed off, I'm sure, thinking, why didn't he introduce me to Paul Newman? And Paul Newman said, "I'm so relieved. I kept seeing you write brother, brother, brother. And I thought you were a religious fanatic. You're going to turn on me." So I wrote it very quickly. And it was only a 4-week shoot. And we put a crew together very quickly. We were trying to get African-Americans as heads of departments. And the great thing was, as new in the business as we were, when we saw Ernest Dickerson's reel, which included Spike Lee's first kind of student movie, he was the best cinematographer we saw, besides being African American. So that was an easy hire.
So the cinematographer is the one who went on to do the right thing.
He shot most of Spike's movies, yeah, and he's the director now. Ernest has shot a lot of.
I didn't even realize that, and that's amazing. Yeah. And the film had echoes of Do the Right Thing and other Spike Lee films in that sort of gritty early 80s.
Ernest, it was the first movie he shot in 35mm, which didn't really make that much of a difference. And, you know, we really talked a lot about the color palette, and he and Spike had gone to NYU film school together, as did Frank Prinze, who was a camera assistant on it. So they'd kind of gone through making student films together and all that. And he had been a still photographer earlier as a career, not on movies, but just, you know, taking stills, and just new movies, you know, was a big science fiction fan. So really a good collaborator in that way.
Had you crossed paths with Spike at this point or any time around?
I think we interviewed him to be the first AD and felt like, well, this guy's way too experienced. He's not going to be happy as a first AD. the guy I did work with, Marco Williams, became a really kind of distinguished, documentary maker after. He made the two Jaspers and Where Are Our Fathers and a couple really good documentaries. That was the only time that I met him. And then was, you know, I was like, sure, he's a good, you know, because I had seen Joe's Bed-Stuy Barbershop, his student movie, which is maybe 15 minutes long, something. And it's a real movie. It's very good. And you just knew this guy's going to have a career.
Wow. Now, is it true that you got a MacArthur Genius Grant and that you used that money to fund the film?
Not to fund the film, but I got it right about when we were ready to go into editing the movie. And so I didn't, in order to rent the machine and all that kind of stuff and go into the sound mix for Brother, I thought I was going to have to wait and take another writing job and wait until I got paid for that to afford the writing. You know, because it was a self-financed movie, I didn't have to have completion money. I just had to start it with enough money to get it in the can, as they used to say, back when they came in cans. And so I had finished it, and it was like, okay, I got to look for a job now. And then I got this award. And in those days, they dealt it out over 5 years, and it was based on your age. Mm-hmm. And so I was 30-something, and so I got something like $34,000 a year tax-free for 5 years.
Hmm.
Now they give it in a lump sum, but, you know, back then that's how they did it. So I got $34,000, which, you know, on a movie that was only costing, I think, something like $300,000 was good enough to get us through post without me having to take another job.
I got to ask, you know, what does winning a genius grant do for your ego? It must feel good.
It was a total surprise. I had never heard of it. You don't apply for it. You know, they check you out and they tell people who they check you out with not to tell you, because most people don't get it. So it was great to get. You know, my favorite story was a year later, Maggie and I went to Madagascar. You know, just on a trip, we were in the neighborhood in Africa, and we just, let's go to Madagascar. Nobody goes to Madagascar. And we were literally crossing a rope bridge over a chasm.
Okay.
And this white woman starts coming across us with another person. And we had read this article where a woman who had gone there, who was not a professor of anything, she was just a lay person who got interested in primates. She had discovered a new primate. And was studying lemurs and all the you know, prosimians on Madagascar. We said, that must be her. And we met in the middle of the bridge and said, did you just win a MacArthur Award? And she said, yeah, what is it? Do you know anything about it? And I said, well, I won. You know, let's sit and talk. And so I was able to tell her how lucky she had just gotten.
A little genius convention.
Yeah, but it only lasts 5 years, so I'm an ex-genius.
So, it sounds like it came together in a whirlwind, but let's just slow down a bit and talk a bit about, first of all, what were you trying to achieve with it? I mean, this is unusual. You had a dream about African-American man walking around seeming out of place in Harlem, and from there, did you conceive of a socially, invested and enlightened film? Because that's really what it is.
Yeah, you know, I had spent some time in Harlem. I'd spent some time in other black neighborhoods in different places I lived. And some of what I wanted to talk about was waste and waste of human potential. And, you know, and race is a big part of that. You know, the most famous stories in our, you know, kind of national lore are about people like Jackie Robinson and the people who came before them who didn't get to play in the major leagues. But, you know, that's just the athletes who didn't get a fair chance. You know, you think of all the educators and doctors and scientists and everyone who just didn't get the education, or if they did, then there was a ceiling because they were black. They weren't considered, you know, worthy of the next step. And here's a guy who has all these talents that are extra human talents, and he kind of has to hide them. And when he gets here, he, as I said, he, you know, literally at one point in the movie, he takes his eyeball out, leaves it, and puts it back in and sees what it saw while he was elsewhere. I wanted to see the world through somebody's eyes who would be treated like he should be there, but he knows nothing about it. So when you see things through his eyes, you really say, oh, yeah, this is pretty gnarly. You know, how come everybody is afraid of the police up here? You know, how come, you know, there's needles with drugs still in them on the ground in the playground? You know, how come this is going on? You know, one of the first things that happens in the first reel is, he looks in a window and there's a crucifix. And there's a guy nailed to the cross. It's like, oh my God, this is a tough planet. You know, and then he turns and he sees a black kid getting, who was actually Giancarlo Esposito in one of his first, non-speaking roles in the distance, getting thrown up against a car and frisked by the cops. And he's just realizing, oh God, I got to watch out here. You know, there are serious consequences. I don't even know what you can do is wrong, but I know I'm a trespasser here. And I don't know the rules, so I better watch it. And then the next thing, he sees a cop, and he just runs automatically. I wanted that eye. And then also just Harlem, like Hollywood, it's a real place, and it's also something iconic in people's imagination. And just like if you go to Hollywood, it's very different than what people imagine it is. You go to Harlem, it's very different what people imagine it is. An interesting thing that happened with us was that because we had a lot of African-American crew members, a bunch of them had been told by their parents, don't go up to Harlem, it's too rough there. And they ended up getting apartments up there because, you know, once you knew the place, you know, oh, well, here's like anywhere in New York City, this is the places you hang out, and this is the places you avoid.
Right. And now, of course, it's one of the most desirable areas in Manhattan.
Yeah. And I was struck by how it still had, there were neighborhoods and traditions there that were very Southern, because I'd spent a lot of time in the South, you know, because of that kind of pipeline of people coming up from the South.
So, you know, I know you work with a kind of repertory, or you return to the same mm-hmm. actors again and again, and your lead, Joe Morton, is one of those. Was this the first film you guys worked on together?
Yeah, I knew of Joe when he came in to read for it. And what I knew of him is, oh, he's that guy who does Shakespeare with an incredible voice. And of course, we're reading somebody for a part that has no lines.
I know. Talk about ironic.
The actors were coming in, and we were just talking to them. And Joe talked about, well, I kind of understand this kind of fish out of water thing. You know, I was a military kid, and, you know, there I was in Okinawa, and there I was in Germany. And then when I came back, you know, there I was in Harlem, and I was just as exotic, you know, having come from these foreign countries there as I was when I went to Okinawa. And I just got the feeling, you know, this guy's he's a good actor. He gets the part. It's going to be tough, you know, and I think he can handle it. And a lot of what I said to Joe is, look, I've got 4 weeks to shoot this, on location. We're going to be running and gunning. You have to mentally and physically assimilate during this, so the guy who's first there doesn't know what's going on. By the end of the movie, he can pass. I'm not going to be able to tell you where you are all the time. We're going to shoot way out of sequence, and so you're going to have to keep track of that, and we'll just talk before the scene about kind of where you are in that spectrum. But you're going to have to do a lot of the work here, and he was just a great collaborator, you know, in that way. Of, you know, kind of keeping track of things. I noticed that he stayed away from the other actors before the scene started, because I don't do kind of acting rehearsal. And what happened with them is what happens very often. If somebody doesn't speak your language, or they have a hearing problem, people started to talk a little louder to him, and be, you know, and that would last for a take and a half or two takes. And then they would get used to it, and, oh, that's just Joe, and then they would relax it a little. And so an awful lot of what you see in the movie is the first take.
Where he truly is alien to his fellow actors.
Yeah.
Did you ever consider giving him lines, or did you know from day one that this was going to be a mute?
No, I wanted the character to be mute, because that it also brings in the idea that people have to work to communicate with him. And he has to understand a bunch of languages in it. So, you know, in the opening scene, you hear some Haitian French, you hear some Puerto Rican Spanish, and this and that. And there's, you know, but I said to Joe, if you can look somebody in the eye and they're talking about something that has some kind of emotional content for them, you can kind of understand what's going on. The one place that's not going to work is when Fisher Stevens comes onto the train and does this card trick with them.
Amazing.
Those are just words, and there's no real people behind it. And so he's just, what's he doing? You know, what are these pictures of things on these little cards, you know? And he walks away kind of stunned by that.
Let's just talk about that scene. I did not remember it. So first of all, this is a very young Fisher Stevens. I mean, he looks like you pulled him out of high school or something. And
well, Fisher had been in, he had been in Baby It's You, which I had made.
Okay.
And, you know, survive. You know, a little bit of his stuff got cut, but he was still in it. And one of the things that Margie Simkin, the casting director, told me is that when she brought him in, he was a very new actor. And she said, you know, okay, well, I don't have anything for the reasons. Well, let me show you a card trick. And he did that card. So basically, I knew that Fisher could do this card trick.
Okay.
So in the screenplay, it just says, it's not written out. It's just, he does a card trick. And then Fisher did it on the day. We did it, and it was very expensive and almost unheard of to actually shoot in the subways of New York then. So there was a subway museum in Brooklyn, which had a car. And if you rock the car and you run some strip lights by it, and have the people go like this. It looks like it's moving, and then you add the sound of it later. And at the end of the scene, the doors open, and the conductor says, you know, 96th Street, 125th Street, next. And what I said to the extras is, when that happens, you know, all the white people get off. And one Japanese guy raised his hand and said, what do I do? Well, that's the story of your life, right? I think you'll get off too.
Yeah, that was so great. I mean, it's a great trick, actually. I wasn't sure if he was really doing it or if it was faked, but
I think we did two takes, and they were just as, you know, and Fisher's so good with that stuff. I tried to cast him in another movie, and he got a much like a lead in a movie, and I was going to have him for a small part. And he's the only actor who didn't have his agent call me. He called me personally, which I really appreciate. he's somebody I run it. You know, he's become a producer and director, right, and stuff like that.
Now, a lot of the scenes take place in this bar in Harlem, mm-hmm, with a great cast of African-American character actors. And, definitely, again, gave me that sense of the Spike Lee sort of camaraderie and comedy that came later in other films. But this was before those. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about how you cast those guys.
Yeah, I had worked with Steve James, who plays the bartender and owner of an Odell. He had been in a play of mine called Turnbuckle that was kind of, it was about a guy whose marriage is breaking up, and he's, you know, he's kind of falling on hard times, but done as a professional wrestling match. So there would be scenes, and then the characters would go in the ring and have allegorical fights with each other. And there was a lot of wrestling in it, which was fun. And Steve had been in that in one production of it. And then we did another production of it. And Tom Wright, who plays the social worker who comes in, had been in that. And I got to know that they were both stuntmen actors. I think at one point they were in Fort Apache, the Bronx, and they were cops, and they actually played gang members throwing glasses and bottles down at the cops that they were playing. So they actually got to fight with themselves in a movie. They were in the Warriors, that movie.
Which is another episode we're doing. It's funny, your name keeps coming up throughout the season. We did Desperately Seeking Susan with Susan Seidelman, and you came up in that one. And you just seem to be the Kevin Bacon of indie cinema.
well, we were making movies and hiring people early in their careers. So they, Tom and Steve, had both worked at the O'Neill Center, and Fences had its first reading there as a staged reading. And they said, there's these two guys in this. You got to hire them, Bill Cobbs and Leonard Jackson. And so that's where I got those two guys. I ended up getting to work with Bill Cobbs a couple more times. Leonard was in Color Purple. He plays her father in that, or Danny Glover's father, I think, in that. Ren Woods was in the movie of Hair. She's a wonderful singer. She played Odell's wife. So there were, you know, guys. Daryl Edwards has been in a couple more of my movies since then, and just a really fun guy to work with. And we were shooting in a bar in Harlem that we had until 6 o'clock at night when it opened.
Okay.
And so basically every day we were really working hard to meet our time. And the big fight scene at the end of it, we also had to finish by 6 o'clock, and we got to this point where I had like 21 shots planned for the fight, which I worked out with Steve James and Tom Wright, because they were stuntmen and they were in the scene, and we were like 12 into it. And I said, okay, we've got to finish this fight in three moves. And so right, that's when we just said, okay, we're going to skip the middle, and we're going to throw some pool balls and get these guys. And then, Tom, you're going to double Joe Morton, and you're going to do this flip with a trampoline. And he was in the air at about 2 minutes of 6 o'clock, and he hit the ground, and we just had our hands on everything and wrapped out so they could open the bar. So you weren't too far from the ambiance. We had a couple guardian angel street people who would come for lunch every day, or there was a shot at night when I think it's Reggie Bythewood is found dead in the parking lot, and the brother shoots himself up with whatever's left in the needle, and he comes toward the camera, and we did this very woozy 360. Mm-hmm. And it's woozy because we had 300 people at 2 a.m. who had nothing better to do than watch us shoot this movie. And they weren't going anywhere. We didn't want to, kind of push people around in their own neighborhood. So Ernest just said, well, I'll start the 360. And when I come to them, I'll go like this. And he's stoned. So it'll look like it's part of him, his drug reaction. But people were, it was fun. It was really fun shooting up there. People got into it, asked what it was about. My first AD, Craig Rice, who later became like the road manager for Prince, was a wonderful AD, but also he's an African-American man who's telling everybody what to do. And everybody assumed he was the director. So I got to just look like the world's laziest PA and sit on a car hood somewhere. And he got all the questions.
That raises the question, like, did people question your authority or the authenticity because you were the writer and in charge?
Not really. Not, back then it was more truly the only kind of sad reaction was a couple times people, when we were doing the men in black scenes and we were chasing them, we would describe the scene and say, well, he's a runaway slave from outer space. People would say, oh, they have it there too. and which you totally understand. But I think just because the crew was so mixed, and the cast was almost all African American, it just looked like, well, this is what belongs in Harlem.
Right. So just to a quick rundown of what happens in it, an alien lands on Earth, and he is the only thing that really would set him apart from being a human is that he has 6 toes, 3 on each foot.
Yes, and he tears his leg off below the knee on his landing, and it regenerates by the next day.
Right.
We don't usually do that as human beings.
Yeah, he has an amazing ability to repair either human tissue that's been damaged or mm-hmm. also electronics just mm-hmm. by putting his hand on it, and it glows. Was that mm-hmm. like a practical effect? Did you have some kind of flashlight?
Yeah,
under
just a little light bulb down his sleeve. I said when the board on the spaceship that he lands. LEDs had just hit the market. You could get them down on Canal Street. Okay. It was a very, very new technology. And so I said, now that people have seen ET, I want people to know in the first 5 minutes, this is a $1.98 version of Star Wars. This is really, really down and dirty. And so we made this very, very simple crash. And, the wide shot of the spaceship arcing into the harbor was made with construction paper and a pin. Really just one after the other, which made this white streak. And then I went into the microphone, and that was the sound of it. And then we put a splash on. That's how basic it is. It was before morphing, which was before CGI, so we didn't have any of that kind of stuff.
And you go with it, though. I mean, there's something so honest about the characters and the dialogue, and that you're willing to suspend disbelief and just go with the story, which is, I think, a sign of great filmmaking.
Yeah, and it's meant to be. He's from outer space, but here he is in Harlem.
Right.
It's interesting. I mean, one of my favorite science fiction writers was Philip K. Dick. And I guess Blade Runner is the most famous of the movies that was made from mm-hmm. his stuff. And his whole thing was, yes, technology is going to be incredible in the future, but we're still messed up people. There's still going to be garbage, and there's still going to be bad politics, and there's still going to be, you know, people with mental problems, and, you know, which he had himself. And I just felt like, yeah, well, science fiction, you know, Kurt Vonnegut always said science fiction is the most philosophical genre because it's always what if, what if, what if. Well, what if somebody from outer space who doesn't know where any of his own people are crash landed in Harlem? Well, A, he'd be lucky because there's places where you don't want to crash land if you're a black man.
Right.
And B, he'd have to figure out quickly if he wasn't going to be just kind of poked and prodded as some kind of creature from, you know, outer space, how to assimilate and how to pass.
Just hearing that Philip K. Dick quote, and I just find that the whole thing is very prescient. The film is very prescient. You know, I mean, look at 2022 and where we are with technology and the state of things, and that sort of, you know, friction. And there was a lot in the film that I feel like predicted a lot. First of all, the main thing he fixes is video games, which were still consoles at the time, and very fun to watch on screen, you know, as a throwback to the 80s. But it just, I feel like that was a smart move on your part, like anticipating the direction we were going.
And a lot of them were space games.
Right.
So it kind of tied in with how he got there.
Right. You know? I noticed you throw in UFO stuff on the TV and on tabloids, and there was little UFOs everywhere. And then the other thing is just the, the issues that were coming up, a lot of it about immigration. There's one speech where he's taken in by a kindly woman, and your character, along with David Strait there, and you play Men in Black. You're basically ICE agents for extraterrestrials.
Right.
And she gives an angry speech about, you know, this whole thing is a scam. You know, you just want this piece of paper.
We would like to ask you some questions.
If you're looking for Bobby, I have no idea where he is.
We have reason to believe that this man has been living with you.
He comes and goes. Right now he's gone.
Where does he work?
Here and there. He fixes things. What do you want with him?
Immigration.
Immigration? Give me a break. We had a kid overdose right downstairs last night, and you're pestering people about whether they got some piece of paper that says they're illegal?
Will he be coming back tonight?
You want to know what my opinion is?
Just facts, ma'am.
My opinion is that you people just made up this immigration scam just to keep people under your thumb.
Is he coming back tonight?
What am I, his mother? Wait for him. See if I care. Just don't do it in my kitchen.
Ma'am, have you ever looked at his feet?
What are you, sick?
I just thought, wow, that could have been told, I mean, this week. You know, stuff has not changed.
You know, it was already happening. It didn't get as much ink as it did before. But, you know, so many people in New York City were immigrants even at that time.
Sure,
You know, there were an awful lot of Haitian people who had come. It was a time when you kind of knew where the hot spot in the world was by driving, you know, riding in taxis. So it was like a year where every taxi driver you got was Israeli, you know, and then it might be Greeks, and then it might be, you know, people from Eastern Europe or whatever. There was a couple of years where it was people from Africa, you know, who were coming in who didn't necessarily speak much English. And you just feel like, well, some of them are going to get to be citizens. Some of them are going to stay under the radar and get to stay, whether they're citizens or not. But that's the story of, you know, certainly my people came here right around the turn of, you know, around 1900. Some of them didn't speak English when they came. And so, and I'm always interested in assimilation. You know, what do you give up and what do you get? And can you break that tie, you know? And the, you know, when the Men in Black come, it's just like, oh my God, you know, he's doing pretty well here. And then these guys show up and is he going to be snatched back? And some of that was, you know, I bring it into the film later, you know, there was this period when slavery had been abolished in the northern states, but it was still the law of the land that if black people escaped, enslaved black people escaped and got to this, you know, slave catchers can come up and claim them, and the courts had to give them up and let them go back, which is why eventually they were going all the way to Canada.
And that brings us to the sort of racial elements that you very bravely confront head on and are very compellingly done. And it doesn't feel dated at all. It feels very current. And there's one scene where you have two tourists, white guys from Indiana, who get lost in Harlem, and they wander mm-hmm. into the bar. And you make it very funny, but there's that sort of awkward two solitudes not quite knowing how to relate to each other.
Yeah, I mean, they you know, at the end of it, they think they've had this wonderful conversation with this guy, but the audience right. realizes he can't talk. So it's a very one-sided conversation, and they're kind of scared and thrilled to be in Harlem because it is iconic. And they can go home and say, "Hey, we went to Harlem. It wasn't that bad. You know, we left there feeling fine." But then the bartender does come over and tell them, "Here's the quickest way to get back into the subway."
Yeah, get out of here.
Because you don't want to be hanging around out here.
It's 8 o'clock. Jeez, will you look at that? This is really something, huh? Wander in here off the street. I mean, if people would sit down and talk like this more often.
Communication. That's what it's all about.
Three blocks south, one block east, subway entrance. You want the A train downtown.
Okay, right, thanks.
Yeah, and then one of the guys gets drunk and talks about how he had admiration for a black baseball player.
And that's that's something that's in a lot of our movies, which is sports and music are the first places in the United States where races met historically. Mm-hmm. And so even in the segregated days of the Cotton Club, white musicians would come and they'd hang out in the alleyway smoking marijuana and listen to the black players inside. And then they'd get together and they jam together somewhere.
Right.
And they almost never appeared on the same stage, but they did play together. Mm-hmm. And the same thing, like my grandfather was, kind of, semi-pro ball player for, $10 here, $15 there. And he said, "Oh yeah, we used to play the black teams all the time." But they weren't integrated, but they met, their fans would be in the stands, usually in different sections and stuff like that. And then eventually it's like, if you can play, you can stay. And that goes for music as well as sports. And eventually you get these people, all these young white kids who grew up idolizing Michael Jordan and wanted to wear his sneakers or some rap guy, and wanted to be a rapper. That's where things start to cross. They don't cross all the way, but they do at least start to cross. And it's one of the reasons we don't have a boring culture.
You could say that again. Yeah.
Yeah. For years I was trying to, get a project about Louis Armstrong off the ground. First with Charles Dutton, who I had worked with. He asked me to come in and write it for him to direct. And then I went around with it, with John Singleton. And we never got off the ground, but what a lot of that was about was, if it wasn't for Louis Armstrong, we would have had 20 more years of Rudy Valley. He had that much impact on even white singers, like Bing Crosby and people like that. Just in, you could do that with your horn and your voice. We don't have to sing like Rudy Valley anymore. We can go into another thing, even if it didn't get integrated on stage in most cases.
Wow, yeah. I'm surprised they've never made a proper biopic of Louis Armstrong. Yeah, we got to get that one underway. Mm-hmm. All right, are you listening, Hollywood? But speaking of music, he falls for a lounge singer, which isn't, a sort of romantic diversion in the film that works very well. What could you tell me about the woman who plays the singer?
Yeah, we read a bunch of people for it, and Dee Dee Bridgewater came in, who was, she was kind of a jazz singer at that time, but she was also looking into acting roles. She's for years done a kind of Billie Holiday night, you know, and I think she may do Dinah Washington as well, and does a little, you know, talking in between, a little bit of acting. And quite a good actress, even though she didn't really follow up doing that. And she needed to be a singer. And I just said, well, this person has got to sing, you know. And so we had a couple singers who weren't really actresses, but I needed both for that. And so she was just fun. You know, we only got to work with her a couple days, but really a nice person to work with.
Listen, I'm going to sit here for a minute, but don't get any ideas, all right? The man that owns this club has been on my ass since I opened here, and I'm trying to keep him off of it. So if he comes by, you are my gentleman friend from Philadelphia, okay? Well, what's your name, honey? You can't talk? Well, some alibi you're going to be. You can hear, can't you? You like my singing? Oh, well. My voice isn't what it used to be when I was with the girls, but it's got character.
There you are, precious. How's my girl tonight?
She was great. And, you know, what I love about the film is that he never talks, but he's becomes a kind of mirror for people to open up whatever's eating away at them.
Yeah, and because they don't, well, he's not going to tell anybody else what I just said to him. No, yeah. I used to hitchhike a lot in the late 60s and early 70s. And you within 2 minutes, once you're in the car, you realize I'm either the entertainment or I'm here to listen. And a lot of times you were there to listen to somebody's troubles because you're like the perfect shrink. They're going to let you off and say, hi, have a nice life. You're never going to meet anybody they know. There were a lot of Vietnam vets, you know, within 3 minutes. Well, I've never told anybody this, but, and you'd get this load that they got to unload on you. And you know, sympathetic as you can be, but you're also walking out of their life from them. So they don't feel like any of that's going to come back to them. So somebody who's very attentive to you, because he had to look you in the eyes to understand what you're saying, but doesn't comment on it, is like a great listener. And everybody likes a great listener if they want to, they've got something to. So in a way, yeah, it's people show their speed when they're talking to somebody like that.
Yeah, and he has an openness to him. There's something, you know, we did another one was After Hours, where your name came up. And both in Griffin Dunn's character and him, there's a sort of just like sweet, like blank everyman quality that reminds me of, you know, some of the silent greats. I mean, in this case, he's literally silent, you know, just these very soulful eyes.
I thought what Griffin did in that was... he's just trying to survive the night.
Yes.
And it just gets weirder and weirder and weirder. And he's just trying to get from one place to another, you know. And then he keeps getting out. And we have this night town sequence in The Brother from Another Planet. I was actually asked from a local college to come and talk to a Dante class about that sequence because – You know, the guy who takes him around on the tour is called Virgil, and there are a lot of parallels between, you know, Virgil guiding the guy and Dante's Inferno. That sequence was inspired for me by a section of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, where he puts on these dark glasses and everybody starts confusing him for a guy named Reinhardt, who's this Harlan character. And then he realized, oh, Reinhardt's a preacher. He's got two or three mistresses. He's a pimp. He's this and that. And it's like, all of a sudden, I can see a whole Harlem that I didn't see before because I've got these things on.
Wow.
And so I wanted, you know, this is a guy and he thinks he knows what's going on. And then he runs into this Rasta, who was a real Rasta, Sidney Sheriff. And he takes a couple hits of marijuana, and then he says, let me show you what goes on at night. And it's a very different story.
Welcome to Babylon, brother. You've got that faraway look in your eye. Come out here with 10 span, realizing the truth, I think. There's many a pearl laying out there for your brother. Don't want to lose your way. Let Virgil guide you, man. I'm informing you on the ways of the night.
Yeah, it's a very cool sequence. That's sort of after he does the drugs that he finds on the street, right?
Yeah.
It kind of takes a dark turn, the film. It's a little bit more lighthearted, and then he sees a guy who ODs, a young guy, and with the needle still in his arm. And he abstains from alcohol for the whole film, but suddenly you're shocked to see that he just samples the whatever that was.
He wants to know what's going... He wants to know what killed that kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because he knows he's not human, you know, and he can regenerate things, he feels like, well, I'll just take a little of this and see what the story is. Why would you put something in your arm that could kill you?
And then he finds this Rasta who takes him on this night odyssey. It's really cool.
Yeah, I didn't want the movie to be about drugs because there's so much more that happens in Harlem than that. But at that point, this is just pre-crack. So it was Harlem got much rougher during crack, like every neighborhood that got hit by crack. And a lot of people had very short lifespans in crack because it kills you quickly. But there was still heroin and cocaine were problems there. And, I just couldn't ignore them. You know, I always feel like if you go through the neighborhood, you got to look at everything that's there. And that was something that was there.
And so he kind of goes on this odyssey, and he meets that woman, and he has all these adventures, let's say. And then at the very end, he's being chased by you and, again, David Strathairn, who, of course, goes on to great heights with his career. It was cool to see young Strathairn running around being menacing with you. And then it ends, spoiler alert, I think people from his home planet, similar to him, come down. And then there's a... The ending is up for interpretation. So he points upwards, thinking he's going to return, and they point downwards, and then we see him on the A train.
Basically, E.T. go home, say, no, we're here.
Yeah. Okay.
Make the best of it. And then the last thing you see is he's on the A train. You know, it's Duke Ellington's song, and the last image is him with, you know, Harlem plays the best basketball or something, and graffiti over one of the high schools.
Right.
So he's here, you know, and there are some other people like him here, but when you see them, they're domestic workers, they're cleaners, they're getting immigrant jobs, and hiding who they are, but at least there's some community here. I'm from Schenectady, New York. Schenectady, New York has a huge community of people from Guinea, Guyana, a Guyanese community, because like two people came and got jobs and then they wrote back home. And then pretty soon it's one of the biggest Guyanese communities outside of Guyana in the world. And that's, you know, that happened with a lot of ethnicities in New York City. And so now there's this alien one. There have been a couple attempts to make it into a TV show, neither of which got off the ground. And what I always wanted to do with it is to make it about immigration, you know, and that eventually in the first iteration, he was going to be a bicycle messenger. If you remember, speaking of Kevin Bacon, when there were a million messengers, because that would get them all over the city and you didn't have to talk. You just handed people messages and, you know, got stuff back from them. And then the second iteration, he was going to stay in Harlem, but kind of be sent out on these jobs with the Chinese people and all the other people who are coming in, you know, people from the Dominican Republic, whatever, because he can kind of understand every language. He can kind of communicate with the people he's working with who are just as lost as he is. And then I also was going to have him learn the North American language of the deaf. And so he was going to be able to eventually sign to some people and have that community as somebody he could really talk to. Somebody could still do a good job of it. I think the nice thing about it is that it played enough that a lot of people got to go to Harlem who never would go there and see stuff that wasn't just about, you know, drug wars.
Yeah, I mean, I think it. I remember it very clearly. I remember my older sister telling me about the three toes and me having to see what it was all about. And I think it made a big impact. And it's I think a cult film. We could call it that.
Yeah, I think it still gets seen. And you know, every once in a while, a basketball player will get called the brother from another planet or the mother from another planet or something like that. So people who haven't even seen the movie know the phrase.
Yeah, it definitely has a ring to it. And if you wouldn't mind telling me what you're up to lately, I'm just curious what's going on.
Let's see. The last thing that I wrote that got made was a Mexican movie called Sonora that came out last year. That I actually won an Ariel for, which is their Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I have a book, another novel coming out in February called Jamie McGillivray, which is like a big historical novel that starts at the Battle of Culloden and ends at the Battle of Quebec. And I'm currently working on another novel. And then I was, I have a meeting later today with some of the producers. I was working with Doug Trumbull when he died on a movie that would have been kind of an extension of his ideas that were in Silent Running. And you know, with Doug's kind of technical expertise, would have been a movie that looked like a $200 million movie made for maybe $60 million.
Okay.
And after Doug died, the producers decided to keep working on that. Like everybody else, I think they're thinking of making it into a series rather than a feature. It's very hard to get features off the ground if they're not from a, you know, like a Marvel kind of factory, you know, where the characters are already established. I have the usual two or three movies that I've written that I'd like to be able to get financed and made, but truly this is a really hard time for independent movies to get financed and seen, because it's still kind of up in the air how many of those movie theaters are going to stay open for people to see them. And if your stuff doesn't fit the algorithms of the streamers, you're just left out. You know, it's just, well, you know, that scans too old for the audience we're going after. And one of the things you're always dealing with them is they're not necessarily looking for something that's going to please the people who have already signed up or of a certain age. They're looking for new people who are mostly going to be very young. So you know, the usual thing that everybody who's scuffling to make movies do, which is, you know, every once in a while I get a bread job writing something, or rewriting something for people. I have a couple movies that I'd like to get financed and direct. And then this thing with Doug Trumbull, who knows what will happen with it, but it was really fun working with him.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're still, you know, very active, and you know, it's, you're obviously a huge talent and a god of indie cinema, so we all appreciate your contributions, and it's thrilling to just spend some time with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Seth.
Thank you, John Sayles, giant of American independent film. That was a thrill to meet you and get to talk to you about this movie that really you know, I hadn't seen it since the 80s, and I watched it, and you know, it hits you in a different way as an adult, but it really works. It's wonderful. So if you've never seen The Brother from Another Planet, I of course encourage you to watch it, as I do all the films we cover on It Happened in Hollywood. And I don't know how this happened, but next week is our final episode. It flew by, and this is a really special episode. We have Julian Fellowes, who is probably now best known as the writer, creator, big boss on the Downton Abbey series and the films, the two films that came out of that. And now he's doing The Gilded Age for HBO, a huge budget historic drama. But he got his start with this film, Gosford Park. It was one of Robert Altman's last films and one of his highest earning films. It's kind of Downton Abbey-esque, but it's set in the 30s, so a little bit later. And it also has an Agatha Christie angle because there's a murder. It's a wonderful, wonderful film. It won him an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay, which he was quite tickled about and told great stories. So please come back next week for our season 3 finale. It's Gosford Park. It's on all the streamers. And until then, we'll see you in Hollywood.